Nemoto presents theater for beginners. Plotus, farce, and stock characters. Narrated with Microsoft Azure using the Ava voice. Running time, approximately 30 minutes. Theater for Beginners is your honest doorway into the stage where civilizations learn to think out loud. In each episode, one writer and one living question, why does this still hit us in the chest? No jargon, no gatekeeping, just story, stakes, and the human choices that won't sit quietly. You'll meet the architects of drama and comedy from Athens to Edo to London, Aeschylus turning grief into law, Sophocles giving conscience a spine, Euripides dragging the sacred into the kitchen, Aristophanes laughing politics back to its senses, Zemi shaping silence, Shakespeare setting language on fire. You leave each episode with more than a plot. You leave with a tool. How to argue without cheating, how to spot a pretty lie, how to stand your ground without becoming stone. If you've ever felt theater was for other people, this is for you. One clear voice, rich storytelling, scenes you can see in your mind, and the quiet conviction that old plays are not homework, they're field guides for today. He is the moment when Roman theater stops bowing to Greek prestige and starts laughing in its own accent. Plautus does not give Rome philosophy in verse. He gives it appetite with timing. He takes Greek new comedy, neat plots about young men, strict fathers, clever slaves, prostitutes, pimps, soldiers, and translates it not only into Latin but into a Roman public's nervous system. The scene is a festival. The performers are a troupe. The stage is a wooden platform thrown up before the temple with drums and reed pipes warming the air. The audience is a swarm of citizens, freedmen, slaves, boys, sellers, gawkers, magistrates who paid for the show, and opportunists who have brought their arguments as well as their children. Farce is not beneath them. Farce is the civic oxygen that helps a republic breathe when law and war and debt have made the chest tight. What Plautus knows, and what you can feel even in translation, is that comedy becomes a public service as soon as it looks like mischief. He writes the laughter that releases and the laughter that instructs, often in the same scene. To name the genre is simple. To feel its pressure, you have to stand in the street. The Roman Fabula Palliata, a play in a Greek cloak, announces itself as an import. Characters keep Greek names. Cities are Athens or Ephesus. Oracles and inns belong to abroad. But the import has been seasoned. The Greek cloak is flung over Roman shoulders and worn like a brag. Settings and plot bones come from Menander and his tribe. The muscle and voice are Plautus. He roughens the texture, adds musical numbers, dares obscene adjectives, lets a line run longer than a grammarian would allow, and then makes the audience cheer the very freedom a schoolmaster will later scold. He writes under the aedile's patronage during the ludi, the games. He knows he must hold a crowd whose attention can defect to a mime, to a vendor's basket, to a rumor. So, he builds scenes with immediate payoff. The prologue often talks to the crowd directly, cutting short the usual noble air of prologues and telling them what they need to know and what he wants back. Patience, ears, applause, sometimes quiet for the tibisson, the flute player who cues the meter. This candor is not crude. It is a contract. Theater is a public bargain here, and the playwright signs with jokes. A Roman stage in Plautus day is all doors and conventions. Two or three house fronts, a street, a temple or an inn suggested with a sign, an altar, perhaps. The magic is not scenery but choreography. When doors slam, farce ignites. A father comes home early. A parasite hides. A lover leaps a wall. A slave calculates. A pimp snarls. The music switches from spoken iambics to a sung canticum with the flute struggling to keep up with a tongue as agile as a parliament of birds. He uses meters like tools. The iambic scenarius carries narrative and argument, the straight medium. The trochaic septenarius has a bounce you can march to. It lifts an audience's feet without its consent. Polymetric songs, the cantica, La Desire and Panic Spill. Plautus is a master of meter as mood. The crowd understands at once what kind of scene has begun because their ribs learn it before their minds do. That is Kraft doing civic work. Language is his mischief and his engine. Plotine Latin in his thick with wordplay, compounds that shouldn't exist and do, puns that survive across 20 centuries because timing makes meaning, alliteration that rattles like dice, invented insults that tell you more about a character than any speech of self-description could. He likes to coin, he likes to bend, he likes to run on. Later purists, Cicero among them, admire him and allow themselves to be embarrassed. They call his Latin unpolished and then fail to resist its vitality. The truth is that he writes like a city that is still making itself, and his pleasure in torque matches Rome's. He does not keep comedy quiet. He lets it crackle. The audience who get the joke about a cooked-up etymology or a crammed internal rhyme feel themselves included in a carnival of sense. The ones who do not get it now will get it three beats later when the slap lands and the custard flies and the whole house laughs at a different temperature. He keeps a stockroom of bodies and minds who walk on as masks and walk off as neighbors. We tag them as stock characters, and after two millennia of imitation, the tag is fair, but stock in his hands is not cheap. It is ceremonial. He places the same masks into different arrangements to test a social mechanism, as a smith tests the same metal by bending it around different pegs. There is the adolescence, the young lover, hot of blood and poor of coin. There is the Senex, the old man, sometimes gruff and virtuous, more often a lecherous fool eager to drink his son's wine and chase his son's mistress. There is the Matrona, the wife whose intelligence is the house's spine and whose patience often outlasts the men's brag. There is the Leno, the pimp whose greed is an ethics and the meretrix, the courtesan whose wit is a weapon and whose heart is sometimes more recognizably human than anyone else's. There is the Miles Gloriosus, the braggart soldier who thinks conquest in bed and conquest in battle are the same sport and whose armor is mostly noise. There is the parasite, the flatterer who eats on compliments and pays with stories. There is the cook who is an artist of grease and a priest of appetite. There is the pedant who knows everything except how to move. But above all, there is the Servus Calidus, the clever slave, comedy's prime mover, plot's mechanic, a mind calculating under constraint. The slave's brilliance is the genre's liberty, the most eloquent insult a republic could offer to its own institutions without canceling the festival. Start with the braggart soldier and watch Plautus teach you how to prick a bubble without spilling bile. Miles Gloriosus gives him a name that tastes like brass. Pergopolinus's, a tower-laying man.
He struts.
He boasts of women conquered by his mere odor. His parasite, Artotragus, fawns with a masterpiece of sarcastic agreement, praising feats so excessive that the audience discovers within flattery the safest form of satire. The real engine is Palaestrio, a slave who was once the young lover's, now trapped in the soldier's house by the tide of theft and sale and accident. Palaestrio recognizes that intelligence in chains is still intelligence. He builds a tunnel between houses. He invents a false neighbor's wife to inflame the soldier's vanity. He arranges disguises and stagey, eavesdropping, so that each mask hears what it wants to hear. He uses a prostitute's pride and a soldier's lust to free the enslaved girl Philocomacium and to make the bully leave with a beating and a lesson. The comedy is mechanical in its precision. Doors, small lies, large egos, a final thrashing that is more musical than cruel. The social essence sits under the slapstick. Authority that mistakes self-regard for strength is governable by the governed. The slave's wit is a mirror in which the officer sees his own medals as toys. When he wants to measure identity's fragility against a city's impatience, he writes twins. Menaechmi is the classic of mistaken identity because the mistake is not merely a trick, it is a civil stress test. One twin, lost as a child, has been renamed by a grieving grandfather. The other grows up elsewhere and comes to town to find him. The city is not patient with doubles. A wife, a mistress, a parasite, a a cook, a father. Each encounters the wrong twin and tests love, loyalty, greed, appetite, and control without knowing which face they are touching. The humor is not only confusion, it is the truth that we rarely see the person before us.
We see our role reflected back.
The wife sees a husband who should behave. The mistress sees a client who should pay. The parasite sees a meal. The merchant sees a debtor. The father sees a boy who should blush. The audience sees how social order relies on repetition and how easily repetition turns to error when a city moves too fast to verify the person. Shakespeare made the comedy of errors out of this not because he needed an easy plot, but because Plautus had discovered that identity is funny in precisely the way it is dangerous. It trains the city to ask for names when faces disagree. He can make greed into music. Aulularia, the pot of gold, opens with a household god, the Lar Familiaris, telling us there is a pot buried in the house of Euclio the miser, because a god delights in irony. Euclio discovers the pot and becomes sickness. Fear that what he has will be taken heats his blood until he is unfit for everything except guarding a hole. He distrusts servants, curses dogs, suspects walls of listening. Meanwhile, his daughter, seduced and pregnant, must be married with a dowry. A rich neighbor wants to help as a way to hold her close. A cook appears to torture him with a profligacy of food and pots and fire. The ending is lost in the manuscript tradition, and every editor in Europe has fantasized a neat closing. But Plautus doesn't need an ending to teach the truth. Miserliness is a plot that cannot end because it cannot spend. The pot is a character. The god in the prologue is a conscience that watches and shrugs. Euclio's mania is a satire of the new Roman wealth culture in a city being flooded with coin from conquest and contracts. He is ridiculous. He is also a warning. The laugh tastes of copper. Mostelaria, the haunted house, is theater about the theater's own inventiveness. Tranio, one of the great clever slaves, must protect his young master's spree from a father's sudden return. He invents a ghost and a haunting on the spot, recruiting a neighbor, bribing a banker, staging peaks and gasps to turn a street into a superstition. The father, the opera pides, is not an idiot. He is a man who wants to be persuaded that what he fears is false. Tranio plays him like the reed a Tibbison plays. The play is a manual on how rumor wins and how a sham, once installed, will defend itself by calling your doubt impiety. It also smells of debt. Parties cost, loans slip into the scene, merchants become characters in a son's moral education. The final forgiveness is not sentimental, it is a ledger. The father agrees to pay if the boy will leave the farce and come back to household truth. Plautus knows that a haunted house is often just an unpaid bill made audible. Captivi, captives, is an anomaly because it abstains from the easy win. There are no women on stage, no meretrices, no pimps, almost no obscenity. A rich Aetolian has lost a son in war and has captured two Aelian prisoners, one a noble, one a slave. He plans a ransom swap, but the men have exchanged clothes and roles. The household slave, Tyndarus, pretends to be noble to save his master. What would be a routine plotline just becomes a test of dignity under humiliation. The slave is beaten and keeps his mask to preserve another's life. The end turns on recognition, yes, but the laughter here ripens into something else, a sense that comedy's masks can measure virtue and that sometimes farce yields a residue of respect. The reward is manumission. The lesson is that nobility is a behavior before it is a birth. The crowd, trained to laugh at liberty as fantasy, gets to watch a fantasy harden into a decree. Comedy has rarely been so tender. Amphitruo is a mythic farce with a jealous god's breath on it. Jupiter, lusting for Alcmena, takes the shape of her husband while he is away at war. Mercury impersonates the husband's slave, Soja. A night becomes long enough for two men to be one, for a woman to be doubly honest, faithful to the man in her bed, and for a slave to be beaten by his own double. Plautus turns the whole absurdity into the grammar of comedy. Doubles, lies, doors, a birth, Hercules, that retroactively justifies a violation in the story the city will later tell about itself. He is not pious in a later sense. His gods are excuses for human weather. He lets Alcmena be as pure as a Roman Matrona and still delivers the child of Jupiter to her arms with a blessing. The laugh is dangerous because it naturalizes manipulation from above. But the play's real heart is Soja arguing with another Soja about who he is. He wants to keep his face in a world where a god can steal it. The scene is theater's self-recognition, a mask telling a mask to hand back the name. Nothing in comedy is more candid. Rudens, the rope, carries a salt smell. A storm at sea, a shipwreck, a pimp's loss of cargo that are girls, a rope hauling a chest, a poor father on the shore, a gruff but kind old man, and a tangled proof of identity that frees the enslaved. Arcturus, the star, speaks at the start in a prologue that feels like a weather report from the cosmos. The local texture is vivid. Fishermen, a cottage, a temple of Venus, the anxious rituals of the lost, and the moral texture, for Plautus, unusually gentle. When Palestra the courtesan recognizes tokens and origins, the crowd gets what it likes best, an ending where enslavement turns into family, lust into wedding, money into dowry. It is not simply a sugar rush. It is a dream told on a shore that also exports slaves. Plautus knows, and sometimes shows, that comedy's liberations are temporary and purchased in the currency of applause, but he spends the coin anyway and feeds the city an image of decency it might later try to imitate. Poenulus stages a Carthaginian father, Hanno, looking for his stolen daughters. He speaks Punic on stage, an outrageous and beautiful thing. Lines in the enemy's tongue during or after a war that taught Rome to hate Carthage. The caricature is there, accent, exoticism. But Plautus lets the man be good, lets his grief be clean, and lets his joy be plural when recognition knits a family back together. He teases Roman ears. Listen, this is how you sound to them. And he refuses to let foreignness be only an instrument of jokes. In an audience that may include veterans of a brutal conflict, the effect is a mild civic medicine. Laughter makes the dose go down. This is not a modern liberal. It is a theater maker who knows that you can soften a citizen's jaw with a pun and then put a human inside a mask the city has learned to spit at. Pseudolus is the clever slave comedy refined into a miracle of confidence. The title character vows to cheat a pimp out of a promised girl and to win money from his master for the trick. He announces his scheme to the audience, taunts his enemies, mocks his betters, rehearses the victory he will perform, then performs it, then throws his garland toward the crowd like a man who has defeated fate. Everything is ingredient. Forged letters, a substitute messenger, a banker's greed, a pimp's greed, a lover's desperation, a father's predictable resistance, a final reconciliation. The music is brassy, the insult spicy, the pace unstoppable. Pseudolus is a demonstration that under the law there is cunning, and under cunning there is joy, and under joy there is a wish that intelligence be sovereign at least for the space between prologues and exodus. The play's true seduction is not the freed girl. It is the fantasy of mastery over a world of rules by someone the rules were built to constrain. A different sort of fantasy hums everywhere in the plays, that a decent household can be reclaimed from appetite and boast and cash. The Matrona is not always a fool's foil. Often she is the household's conscience. Plautus gives her scenes where she names the cost of a husband's lust or the stupidity of a father's bullying, and where she forgives without surrendering her mind. He can be gross. He is often kinder than the genre's reputation. The Meretrix, too, is not just a professional body. She is often the only one who can say true things to a man who believes his coin is charisma. The Leno is the target the audience is safest hating, money that buys flesh. But the best jokes against him are never only discussed. They are also manuals on how to trick a monopolist. The parasite eternally hungry and shameless, exists to flatter and to reveal the nature of flattery. It tells you what you would do if you were starving and had only language to eat with. The Cynic's Amatyr, the old man in heat, would be pitiful if he were not so funny. Plautus lets him fail loudly, because age that makes itself ridiculous tries to buy back youth by spending other people's peace. If you look for political speeches, you will not find many. If you listen for political weather, you will hear it in every line. Rome at the time is learning itself as a metropolis. Wars have filled pockets. Magistracies decorate names. Clients crowd doorways at dawn. Streets are busy with business. And the old agrarian virtue is already a story people tell about then. These plays are about money more than honor. Debts drive plots. Dowries decide faces' futures. Bankers enter to speak law like a priest speaks fate, and contracts sing under the dialogue like a second score. Through this economics, Plautus runs a current of faith in improvisation. He knows that rules ossify. He knows that appetite cheats. He knows that perfect justice is not a thing the city can stage. But he also knows that persuasion is a craft that makes civilization bearable when the rules fail to protect the soft. His clever slaves are also his clever citizens. They do not vote. They write policy in chalk on the street for an afternoon, and the crowd approves. His metatheater is not vanity. It is service. He breaks the fourth wall not to show off but to calibrate the room. Make way for the flute, the prologue might say, or we will play if you will listen, or the aedile wanted this, and I am giving him that. He mocks rival playwrights. He teases the actors by name. He corrects the impatient and flatters the faithful. He announces scene changes like a market crier. The effect is intimacy. A festival crowd becomes his troop's accomplice for an hour. In a society that uses hierarchy to organize nearly everything, Plautus uses address to organize his democracy of laughter. It's not political theory. It's practice. The many are one audience that can be taught to wait for a payoff, to follow a ruse, to admire a snap. He is training attention, and attention is the resource a republic can least afford to squander. None of this would matter if the plays did not move like bodies. Plautus is kinesthetic. He knows how an actor's hips should pivot to make a line land. He knows the comic geometry of three bodies at a door. He knows how a cloak becomes a character when it hides a face, how a wig on a bald head can become a conspiracy, how a rope pulled hand over hand can generate suspense more honest than any flourish of prophecy. He uses repetition not to dull but to sharpen. A catchphrase returns like a drum to coordinate a crowd's laughter. He loves a catalog, a list of dishes, a list of fake credentials, a list of beatings threatened, and he loves the way a list can speed up like a cart behind nervous oxen. The flute player, essential and often ignored by readers, is his timekeeper and his collaborator. The best jokes are duets, text and breath. If you are looking for a single moral, ask instead for a set of procedures a city can use when it is tempted to harden into a machine. First, honor craft over station. The right plan in the wrong mouth may still save a house. Second, beware of men who think authority is a substitute for charm. They will always be disarmed by a joke that reminds the crowd of weight and measure. Third, give your women more lines. They will do the accounting the men postpone. Fourth, remember that debt speaks a language theater can translate. Alone is a plot, and the only way to end it well is to incorporate its cost into your ending without pretending to erase it. Fifth, if you cannot end justly, end with mercy and a song. That is not a lie if you remember tomorrow morning to behave as if the mercy happened. He fathers a continent of laughter after him. Commedia dell'arte, with its masked types wandering Italian squares for centuries, is a grandchild who kept the family features. Pantalone is Plautus Senex. Il Capitano brags like Pergo Polonuses and runs as fast. Arlecchino is the acrobatic, clever slave at liberty. Colombina is the maid who cannot be tricked. Dottore is the pedant whose learning thumps when it lands. Molière raids Amphitryon directly and takes the miser and the hypochondriac and the misanthrope from a French street, but gives them Plautine spines. Shakespeare swallowed him whole and burped up masterpieces. Comedy of Errors is Menaechmi with English weather. The Taming of the Shrew rests on rehearsed humiliations that Plautus taught Europe to laugh at and later ages had to unlearn. The Merry Wives of Windsor makes a Senex a Mautier into a knight. Elizabethan low scenes, the rustics, the watch, the rowdy inn, are Plautus decanted into English ale. Ben Jonson, who loved classic models, knew exactly how Plautus stacked his scenes. Restoration comedy of humors owes its clockwork to these Roman afternoons. In the modern musical, a brilliant proof, a funny thing happened on the way to the Forum takes Pseudolus, Miles Gloriosus, and a whole stockroom of masks, and Sondheim's music ticking like a Roman water clock shows you that timing is still law. To ask whether Plautus is kind to slaves and women by our standard is to ask the wrong test and then be disappointed. He writes Inside a World That Buys People. He sells tickets by telling those people's jokes with more respect than their owners usually give them. His laughter lifts and sometimes stings. A clever slave remains a slave at the curtain. A courtesan may end with a ring and still walk tomorrow past men who know her price. But inside a festival day, he creates a controlled space where wit outruns power and where a crowd can feel, briefly, a society in which brains circulate from bottom to top like a melody. That practice is not nothing. It is how taste for equality can begin in a culture before law admits the shape of the desire. Even Captivi's manumission is a small crack that lets some future air in. He also alters Latin. The poets after him cannot forget the way his lines move. Ennius and Terence will tidy, Cicero will codify, Catullus will refine, Horace will instruct, Juvenal will bite, but all of them will hear a Roman rhythm with trampling feet under their niceties that belongs to Plautus. Terence, his younger, more elegant successor, becomes the schoolroom's favorite. Plautus remains the streets. Terence never hammers when a tap will do. Plautus knows that sometimes only a hammer can sound the timbre. The result is a cannon with both muscle and bone. Soldiers need both. So do citizens. Take, finally, the claim that stock characters are laziness. Watch a master use them, and the claim evaporates. A mask is a promise, not a prison. When the parasite limps on, you promise to laugh at flattery. When the braggart stomps in, you promise to enjoy a puncture. When the clever slave peeks and plots, you promise to admire intelligence operating under constraint. Each promise aligns the room's breath. Farce is coordination, and coordination is what a crowd must practice if it wants to be more than a mass. Stock characters are adjustable tools that keep the rehearsal going. They also remind you of the hardest truth a comedy can deliver. Most of us will spend our lives as somebody else's type unless we learn tricks of humility and grace. Plautus hands out those tricks and riddles, songs, slams, door routines, and expects you to use them after the flute player has gone home. Why does this still land in the chest? Because families still argue at doors, because debt still masquerades as dignity, because old men still believe their desire is adorable, because young men still invent plans that are only adjectives, because women still carry the arithmetic while men sermonize, because servants still find ways to make themselves sovereign for an hour, because swagger still sounds like a broken instrument, because crowds still need to be tuned before they can listen together to anything but their own noise. Plautus gives you the practice without the sermon. You will not leave his plays wiser. You will leave more agile in the way wisdom needs you to be when law turns awkward and appetite is loud. If you are building a beginner's theater series, he belongs near the front because he shows you how comedy becomes a city's health check. Aeschylus legislates. Sophocles calibrates conscience. Euripides interrogates. Aristophanes roasts. Plautus tests joints by making them flex. When you hear the creak, it's not a defect. It's the sound of repair underway. Watch for the flute. Listen for the trochaic gallop. Learn the masks, and then look for them tomorrow at the shop, the office, the clinic, the council. When you find them, you'll have a joke ready that is kinder than scorn and sharper than flattery. You will have the timing to keep your own house from becoming a haunted one. And you will have a memory he left, the picture of a double at a door claiming his own name, that will help you resist the next clever man who tries to talk you out of the face you know you wear.